Welcome to the Speaker's Corner Show. My name is Heiko Kuh. This week's show is a recording from my own meeting from the 19th of September. It's the second part of a meeting. You can come down to Speaker's Corner and join us any Sunday afternoon between noon and dusk, weather permitting, of course. And you can tune in at speakerscorner.net or listen to the program on Resonance FM on 104.4 every Sunday at 4:30 p.m.
Well, according to according to what I've heard from the government, there's going to be a new computer revolution with clouds.
What?
With clouds. You've got to have your mobile phone. Your mobile phone won't do anything. You get in touch with a cloud up there, and the answer will come back.
Yeah.
And this is going to be the new computer revolution, which we're going to make oodles and oodles of money out.
Who is now, the problem, sir, I quite agree with you, it's all the cloud theory of computing, but the problem is that it's not, coming back to what you said about the, it's dependent on a lot of human creativity, but not a lot of human labor. It's the machines that do that. Where are people going to work? How are people going to earn money? The big question, moving away from all kinds of principles, theories, etc., etc. Tomorrow, I want to know where I'm going to be able to get a job.
Well, okay,
in already shrinking and saturated
low-paid service
sectors.
We go to the pharmaceutical industry? So I used to work for Medicines Control Agency. Now, there, the manufacturing of pills is absolutely nothing.
It's all done in India, in China.
Well, no, obviously I've been to a factory in Britain, and they've got like a glorified washing machine, and this guy comes up with his barrow, with it's all laid out for him. He just like shovels it in, sets the machine off, and he mixes it all up, and it comes out automatically on the made into pills. But that isn't where the actual
jobs.
The jobs come from the people that do the the research, the development, the animal testing, the people testing.
So shrinking because of technology. The same thing you just mentioned now about everything being available on the internet or somewhere else. That design. I was speaking to a shoe manufacturer recently. I said, "What do you do now?" He says, "All of our manufacturing is now in China." So I said, "So where are you?" He says, "Well, we design." I said, 10 years from now, what will you be doing? He said, we'll be living in China and designing over there. Or we'll be asking them to. Because the fact of it is that they are cheaper than here. And capitalism looks at the bottom line.
The idea.
So the pharmaceuticals, isn't the cheapest of manufacture?
No, I think,
is the thing.
I think this is a misnomer again.
The money that goes into it is with the research and the development.
I think it's a misnomer
again. That's what the whole place is.
To discuss this question in terms of cheapness. The reason I pointed to the theory for the tendency for the rate of profit to fall is because it is not about the cheap labour. Cheap labour does not determine the development of economy. There are many countries in the world with extremely cheap labour. In fact, one of the characteristics of the recent period in China is the wages have actually been increasing, significantly increasing. And low-cost manufacture has been moving away from China. Over the last 2 years, for example, something like 20 million jobs, manufacturing production, left China, went to Bangladesh or India or Vietnam or Laos or Cambodia because it's cheaper to manufacture in those countries. But that is a certain type of manufacture. What the Chinese government is planning, and that's where the planning principle comes into it, well, the Chinese, because they have big industry under their command, what they're planning and designing is a plan to go up the chain of the production process so that they enter the chain at another level and are able to compete on a world scale with advanced industrialized countries. Again, it's a little bit of a misnomer to discuss Britain as, eradicated of manufacturing. It's also not true. Britain produces as much manufacturing product as it did under Margaret Thatcher at the beginning. even though she came in and destroyed manufacturing in it. She came in and destroyed jobs. She came and destroyed jobs in manufacturing, yes, but she came and destroyed jobs in manufacturing.
Or a country whose richness was built on the Industrial Revolution.
Yes,
you now have 17%.
It wasn't just built on the Industrial Revolution.
Okay, I'm using broad terms.
I understand, but you were implying...
I'm using broad terms.
You were implying...
I'm using the broad terms. And again, I come to the main question again.
One sec.
The main question is, what are the new revenue streams that are going to put people...
Try to answer.
Fine.
The question about what specific products will be the products that make profits is not something that anybody can answer now. It's something that will develop. I mean, it doesn't really matter what it is. Capitalism doesn't produce.
Don't you think it's time to start developing?
Capitalism doesn't produce.
It's time to have those ideas now.
There are plenty of ideas around that can be developed.
I'd like to
there
get, is no, I'm asking you, do you
nanotechnology,
know that
biotechnology, stem cell technology, medical technology, design,
probably,
cloud computing, you name it. There
probably,
are millions of spheres
what you said, sir, probably,
of investment.
What you said, sir. About green technology.
And green technology, of course. However, the question is the production for profit. Capitalism is a system. Capitalism is a system of production for profit. It invests when the profitability rate is sufficiently high for them to sustain a long period of investment. At present, the capitalists are on strike, waiting for the destruction of value, the destruction of material wealth, such that they can reinvest at a new level, gather their capital, cash is king, they say at the moment, gather their capital, wait till prices are cheap, then invest. Now that doesn't just mean labour power, although the European governments are using the opportunity provided by the strike by capital to say we don't need the workers anyway.
Yeah.
Lay them off, drive down their wages, adds to the profitability of companies temporarily.
Yeah.
But ideally, and this is the key,
bankrupt
capitalists will invest when they have sufficient capital stored and when the spheres of investment are sufficiently profitable. So the investment then will result in a huge increase in the number of employees.
In the meantime, by the time this machinery gets going, the country is bankrupt.
That's correct.
That's correct.
We have entered a period. We enter a period, as we know we are in, a period which they call the era of austerity.
Yes.
We are going to witness huge social conflict.
I agree with you.
Once that social conflict has been fought out and the workers have been beaten, then of course that adds to the atmosphere and climate which enables capital to invest and have a flexible, pliant and relatively low wage labour force.
And a bankrupt.
Whilst the labour force of India and China, the urban labour force, by that time, 10 years' time, many of them will be earning the same as we're earning anyway.
Already, right?
Already many of them are. I mean, in Britain, you've only got 35 million people, 30 million people working anyway.
Yeah.
You know, in China, you've already got many people, 30, 40, 50 million earning the same as people here.
600 billion working in India.
600 million.
Million, sorry.
So,
absolutely.
Capital invests when the profit rate is high enough. At the moment, the process is the destruction of capital.
So we're leaving it to the capitalists rather than the government getting taking the bull.
This is the nature of
the bull by the
horn. The fact of the matter is, this is the misunderstanding, which is revealed in the social conflict, is that people begin to understand the truth, which many people know already, but the truth, that government in capitalism is representative of capitalism.
Yeah.
It's not a representative of the people, it's a representative of business
and
interests.
Our friend just said that.
And for that reason, it carries out and enacts policies that serve business and tells the population, the standard phrase invented by Margaret Thatcher, there is no alternative. And this is the general discussion now.
But there is an alternative.
There is no alternative to cutting the welfare state.
But there is.
Because the budget's so tight, we run out of money.
Yes.
And it was all the bank's fault, but that's how it is. And there's nothing we can do except cut back, tighten our belts, make things ready, then they'll invest. In fact,
what do you think could be an alternative?
The alternative is to nationalise the big companies. So take the big companies into public ownership and plan investment, including the banks, and plan investment to serve the needs of the population so that they can identify...
It's welfare capitalism.
Sorry?
It's welfare capitalism.
No, I'm not arguing for welfare capitalism. I'm arguing for socialism. But socialism,
okay, call it socialism.
By public ownership of the big industries and banks, you will be able to plan what you do with the resources in society and stimulate even innovative capitalist companies. But by laying the foundations of investment, for example, allocating cheap electricity to those spheres of the economy where people require a reduction in cost to invest or to engage in production, then you provide them with facilities. Buildings, for example. How many buildings are now seen empty in Britain? It's one after another after another. Even in London, after only 2 years ago. The insanity of capitalism is revealed by that, isn't it? Only 2 years ago, they told the general population, or everyone believed, that the most valuable thing you can get is a house in London.
Bricks and mortar.
Now, everywhere you go, places are empty. So, the insanity of the social system and its organisational form is revealed by that. If you, instead of just allowing the market to decide if someone can afford to rent at the existing price, you provide those facilities for free or at huge subsidy. Then you provide them with cheap electricity. Then people can innovate. And the fact of the matter is, as you're pointing out correctly, the key spheres of technology which are going to be developed in the future, many of them are actually all about innovative capacity.
It is.
And there are millions of people sitting in their homes, sitting on computers, now unemployed or semi-unemployed.
Yeah.
Or employed in industries which are utterly useless for social production and for the development of society. Dying twilight industries who are just surviving by the skin of their neck, keeping up a profit rate by advertising some bullshit to people. Whereas you could innovatively bring people together in cultural and intellectual spheres where Britain has a certain advantage, for example, in music, in culture, in film, in software production, in design. There are advantages which Britain has got, historical advantages, which would enable them to merge together the universities, the colleges, the schools, with production, manufacturing, with innovation, and merge together art, science and culture, and provide facilities that produce this merging of ideas.
Because the ultimate,
and it could be all done almost for nothing.
It's going to be the ultimate thing is going to be whether the government is bankrupt or not, and government revenues stem from many places. One of them is people paying taxes.
It's promoting socialism.
And people only pay taxes if they have jobs. Would you agree with that?
The rest of the world. What was that again? Sorry.
I said governments create revenues from many different things. One of them is taxes. And that is individual taxes as well as corporate taxes.
I think it's quite simple because...
And if I'm not in a job, I'm not paying tax.
Right? So for me, the fundamental of the whole story here, for me, in my opinion, is where are the new jobs going to come from? Some of it you have explained quite clearly, and I thank you for that. And perhaps one day I can take this further with you. That what are the new jobs that are going to be here? That you're going to get hundreds of thousands of people back to work.
There is no problem
where they become.
There's no problem people having work, producing services that people feel they need. If that be cleaning, sweeping the streets, or painting a picture on the wall.
It's still not going to give you enough of a tax revenue to pay for the government.
Because you're expecting more. It is if people consider that the added value is equal to the wealth that they, to the products produced, to the money they earn.
Yeah.
The government, of course, is operating in a different sphere, which is saying what we need to do is cut down the entire state burden, minimise the state, maximise the private sector, and then the private sector will invest. Because the dogma is that capitalists are the driving force of society.
Yeah, but for capitalists like me, for instance, if I was a capitalist, I'm not going to say I'm going to have people walking along the street looking at street furniture to make sure it's okay, which the government employs people to do today. I'm only going to do things that are going to give me a profit. I'm not so my job base is going to shrink. My job base is going to shrink if I leave it to the capitalists. Well, I have to involve.
I tend to agree, but we will see. Long term, it's not necessarily the case.
So, in the interest of being non-conspiratorial, what are the structures of capitalist society which determine the government's actions? Why is it, for example, that Jack Straw used to be a Trotskyist when he was a student, president of the student union, and as soon as a Labour government gets into power, they turn out to be Thatcherites?
It's a little bit before the Labour government came to power that they already became Thatcherites. But there are pressures.
I was going to ask a question. Was Jack Straw an MI5
agent? There are multiple pressures brought to bear to conform, which operate at all different levels. I mean, from when you're a little child, the structure designed to try and make you conform surrounds you. From when you go to university, when you go to college, when you go to work, the structure to conform within the existing format is there. And people learn that behaviour quite quickly.
That happens in every society, doesn't it?
I mean, I was in McDonald's the other day, and there was a girl there, and she was behind the counter. Me and a friend of mine were sitting there, and then we thought she was it was obviously packed out the restaurant and busy, and so we just said, can we keep you busy somehow so you don't have to serve the next customer straight away? She goes, no, my supervisor. and then we just said, what are those products like then, you know? And she sort of went along with it, but it only lasted about 5 seconds, and then a guy came behind her like that, head right going along. And sorry.
I've run away. I've worked in McDonald's, so I know what it's like. It's a factory of burgers.
That's right.
And you're you're going to make. When I was there, we used to have to try and make £100 sales. Right. So, and you have a competition between the teams. So you're running around like an idiot.
Right. So anyway, the point being that your behaviour then becomes fixed. You know what you're able to do, what you're allowed to do, and therefore you do that.
Why is it that the government is so much more vicious? For example, normal Tory supporter, you know, might be a vicar's wife or something. You've got George Osborne, the man's a fucking animal.
Well, once you reach a certain... I mean, there are various levels at which you become accepted within a chain of command. And within this chain of command, going right the way up to the top, they reach the point where they go in their own clubs, their own associations, their own way of behaving. In the past, in England, it was the public schools and so on. To some degree, it still is. But it's more than that. It's an ingrained structural culture within the entire ruling class of the country, which is what forms the class, constitutes its reproductive structure, mental, intellectual, and physical, in the sense of the way they organise power. So it's not just a question about the meanness of it. Many people are mean, you know. You can get a guy down the street, the bus driver, maybe beat his wife at home, Many people are mean. But the question is, what organisational form exists historically, and is it broken? Because it's really, in order to change that, you have to break that structure.
Is it natural selection in politics? The meanest get to the top.
It's not natural selection. It's a selection from above. It's a chain of selection from above. In the military, it's quite rigid and strict, isn't it? The generals have their schools, their training grounds, they try and make up systems for determining who will go up and who will go down. And under capitalist government, they have similar structures. The party, the hierarchy within the party, the hierarchy within the bank, within big business. In many ways, they'll jump from one company to a business, or from one administrative apparatus to a business. Funnily enough, often they avoid the military getting involved in that. But the analogy with the military is quite strong, because they are the most formalized structure of power. But in the informal structure of power, or semi-formal structure of power, they've got many, many institutions, all of which lean on the institutions of the state, such that if you talk, there was a guy there, you remember the other week, there was a guy, you turned around and said, oh, he's a barrister. Oh, he's Queen's Counsel, you said, something like that, right? There was a guy, he started asking, he's like, started pulling one of his strange, how can you say, contortions in his face, but it was the contortions of a member of the elite. It was a member of the old English elite. You know, there was a toffee, a really toffee nosed guy, and you turned around and said, "That guy's Queen's Counsel." You said to me. But there is a certain, now nowadays, of course, there has been some democratization of this process. But you'll find in every country, I mean, even in the United States, where it's much more democratized. I mean, the president can run around in a baseball hat and charge down the street, you know, run around the street in a park, you know. So, but the apparatus of testing is still there. You're constantly, the ruling classes constantly test their own to make sure that they behave the right way. And, you know, and then test those below them, their subordinates. Once in a while, somebody might slip through as a maverick. But then eventually they're sifted out as well.
But then the question is, if it's a question of the cultural reproduction of their class, like they have to get these ideas into their head by doing, you know, getting them to do certain behaviours, how did exactly the same structures arise within the labour movement?
A very interesting question, and that's a long-term historical question about the merging of the labour movement with the state. Because, for example, let's take it at a corporate level. When the labour movement first began, the rulers didn't know what to do with it. Because people would riot, protest, go on strike. The employer, the individual employer, wasn't directly connected with the police because there were no police. The police only came into existence in London 1829. So, very modern phenomenon, the police. They didn't have any police. So if the workers go on strike, you've got to pay a load of gangsters to beat them up. Beat them up, kick them out, get some ore in.
Okay. Right? Yeah.
Or bring in the army, Peterloo Massacre, they brought in the army. So this was the historical origin of that. But then, once the workers' movement became a national movement of sustenance that kept emerging again and again, then the theoreticians of capital began to see it as a long-term strategic problem. And so the way to deal with it was to incorporate. Well, let's allow them the right to vote. That's what speakers call it. They go across the park here. They've got a memorial in the middle of the park there. So the origin of the right to vote, which is fought for by the working classes in London. Once they granted them the right to vote, they said, well, we can have some representatives in the parliamentary system. And these people we will bribe. In fact, Tony Benn, he turned around to one of my comrades in the past years ago, and he said to him, sorry, it wasn't Tony. Tony Gay, you said to him that one of the elites within Parliament, one of the Conservative Lords and so on, he turned around to Tony Benn, he says, you'll never win, you know. And he goes, oh really, why is that? He goes, because we'll always buy your leaders, always. And that is ingrained within the system, is that it is a purchasing shop to buy them. And it works at all levels. The local council, as soon as someone becomes a local council officer, a local councillor, they come under pressure. Yeah, we want to open a Tesco in the local area. We need planning permission from the local council. And we got 10 members of the council, we need to twist their arm. Because they're new members of the council, and they don't know the way they're supposed to vote. They're coming under pressure from local people. I was at a meeting of Labour Party yesterday. And it was a meeting of the left of the Labour Party, Labour Representation Committee. We were discussing about the cuts campaign. So what are we going to do about it? So they said, well, let's make a campaign to approach all councillors, all Labour councillors in Britain, because they were turning around, the Labour councillors were saying, great, the cuts are coming, we're going to get elected next year. And then some of our people, the lefties, turned around and said to them, it's not going to be great for you, is it? If you get elected, you're going to be implementing the cuts. And so what are you going to do about it? If you implement the cuts, you're the ones who are going to become unpopular. Not the Tory party, you are. And so then they turn around, they go white in the face. They go, oh yeah, they didn't even think about it. Because they were thinking about councillor, raising, it's on their CV, you know what I mean? Councillor, get a few handbacks here, easy job, you know, have a good life.
Come in, MP.
That's right, well, there's only so many MPs, there's not a council. So then,
you're on your way, aren't you?
Suddenly, they begin to change their minds. So we can have a campaign now to speak to prospective councillors so that they state in advance, we will refuse to implement the cuts. Now, as it turned out, there seems to be a new law about this, that if they do that, they'll immediately be suspended. But in the past, in the 80s, some of you might remember, when councils refused to implement cuts, they were put in prison, or they were surcharged and made bankrupt. Actually, now the law has changed, and it means that they will be suspended, but you could then demand a new election, and then you would have a new, I mean, in the communities, you would have a different scenario than if that was to be the case, for example. So it's about the pressure of the Labour movement on these people and the militancy of the movement itself. If people are doing okay, and for decades people were doing okay, well then why do they want the trade union? Who wants to go to a union meeting and complain and protest? Only a minority, only the trots and whoever. And so, if there's nobody coming along and demanding that you do something, well then, you get lazy, you make a deal, or you ideologically begin to say, the people don't want to complain anyway. If you meet trade unionists now, activists for the last 20 years, many of them tremendously cynical. And that's why at the TUC, you will have a lot of talk about taking action, but then overall there'll be a significant degree of cynicism, a reluctance to call, because they feel the workers don't want to do anything. Actually, I think the mood will change very rapidly in the next 6 months to a year, and there will be big strikes in Britain, like the strike we saw last week, but on a national scale. I think there will be big strikes, because it's a cumulative process. As your school is affected, your college is affected. There was a thing in the BBC this morning. Survey done. Do people still support the government when it says it needs to make cuts? Yes. Are they prepared to accept cuts themselves? No. That's the contradiction of the phenomenon, isn't it? Everyone's in favour of cuts in general. No one wants themselves to be cut. But we're all going to be cut. And therefore, there will be a cumulative... Now, the government would like...
People can't do anything.
Sorry?
People can't do anything.
Well, that's true. I don't deny. You're right. But I think the cumulative impact will be quite considerable. And then it's the discontent and the way that reflects itself. In the anti-poll tax movement, there wasn't a lot you could do either. Our little tiny Trotskyist grouping organised the whole thing. Organised it quite badly, actually, but organised the whole thing. And because the anger was there, it got rid of Margaret Thatcher, who I remember standing here, and people said, you'll never get rid of her. Never get rid of her. That's what they used to say. So I don't think you have to be cynical in relation to that, but you have to be aware that it is quite a long and bitter battle to change that. And then to change the culture within the Labour movement and to make them accountable, that's the next phase.
That was the Speaker's Corner show for this week. Tune in same time, same place, 4:30 p.m. Sunday afternoons, 104.4 Resonance FM. Come down to Speaker's Corner and join us on a Sunday afternoon between noon and dusk, or visit our website speakerscorner.net.